All right, welcome back. So tonight I would like to get an early start on next month's topic, the addictive mind, partly because there was 5 Mondays in March and it just worked a little bit better with the other things we have planned in April. So the addictive mind, there's a reason I picked that poem, So Much Happiness by Naomi Shihab Nye. You know, one is just to help brighten the mind. When you start to look at addiction and some of these heavier topics in Dharma and daily life, it's helpful to keep the mind bright, have a sense of lightness around it. And also to provide a juxtaposition between the happiness that so often the addictive patterns in us seek. You know, that type of pleasure is very different from the way that she described it, this happiness that can't be contained. And so all you do is you just open your arms and let it flow where it will. So the addictive mind, you know, we all have this capacity. We all have the areas in our lives that we have addictive behavior, addictive qualities of mind. Sometimes, of course, very painful, very destructive, and sometimes just kind of run-of-the-mill addiction that we engage with. And especially when we look at technology and, you know, social media, things of that nature. It's almost wired into our nervous system. And again, sometimes it plays out in real benign ways, and sometimes much more painful and destructive ways. You know, they've, of course, done many studies on addiction and looking at rats, and you can wire their brains in a way that they get a hit of dopamine every time they do a behavior. And so pretty soon they just do that behavior, even at the expense of eating and drinking water. They just crave that pleasure. And unfortunately, our brains are very similar to the rats. And so where's this also coming off this last month's topic of habits and patterns and addiction? You know, where is that line? You know, when does something become is more of a habit and a pattern versus when it starts to have that addictive quality. So I'd like to share with you my kind of working definition of addiction, the addictive mind. And this is, you know, it's not clinical, just more from us to get a handle on it, exploring it with the Dharma. And I have 3 components that I like to propose. You know, first, that there's this behavior that we do that maybe we started with us doing the behavior, but at some point it switched to the behavior doing us, that the behavior is what takes over. It has a life of its own, you know, almost beyond our control. We can notice how easy it is to stop the behavior, and we feel the momentum of that. We get the sense of how addicted we might be to that. So there can often be a sense of compulsion, that sense of urgency or need to continue. You know, for myself, those of you who have Netflix accounts watched like maybe The Queen's Gambit, and having grown up with a grandfather who loved chess and taught all his grandsons how to play chess, I had kind of a natural interest in that. So that kind of re-triggered this, my wife would say, obsession with chess. And so noticing that playing some online games, how if I was in a losing streak, I would just want to keep playing to get that win. And just I could feel almost the urge or the need to have that chemical dump of success. And even though for whatever reason, I was not playing very well. And so it was very interesting just to watch that, how that compulsion, really that addiction showed up in this way. In this way, it overrides our logic, overrides our rational brain. You know, we are really gripped in its power. Right? So this is this first component of what I'm defining as addiction. The second one is that it's tied to some type of benefit or pleasure, right? So the pleasure may be, you know, something chemical, maybe something experiential. It could be something that we really want or long for. And it may be something that's not even completely conscious. Sometimes we engage in behaviors that are addictive and not even fully comprehending how they benefit us, how they serve us in some way. It may not be a very skillful or healthy way, I should say, but it still has that sense of serving us. And of course, sometimes it's avoiding pain is the pleasure that we get, getting away from that pain. And then the third one is that these behaviors also have drawbacks. They have limitations. They have issues that they cause in our lives. And again, we may not be conscious of those. So often there's the denial that we have a problem around addiction that's so common. So these three areas are just this working definition for us to kind of hold this concept of addiction. So I'm not holding whether it's substance abuse, that kind of addiction to just being caught in a particular pattern. Just looking at it from these three parts, that there's this behavior that has its own grip on us. It's harder to stop. That it has pleasure, it has some kind of benefit, and it also has a drawback that's often very significant. And we have other things we do, of course, that give us pleasure in life, but don't have that addictive quality. It doesn't have that compulsion, the inability to let go. And it doesn't have that tendency to overlook its drawbacks and limitations. So I find this is really interesting, this drawback, that we can be addicted to things that cause us long-term pain or difficulty, how there's a certain blindness, a certain delusion or ignorance that comes over us, that we somehow overlook this fact that this is causing harm, and the benefit arises in its place, the pain, the pleasure, the release of that pain, even if we don't see that. I remember a number of years ago, I have shared this story before. I had a kidney stone attack, and I had, being kind of a stoic meditator, I sat with it on a retreat for actually 3 days and finally went to the ER. And of course, after 3 days of this unrelenting pain, I was fairly exhausted. And when they finally put some morphine in my system and that pain evaporated, right then in that moment, I realized, there's that pleasure, that sense of I could see how you could have a pathway to becoming addicted, especially when the pain started to come back and there's that loss of ability to be with it, because I knew the relief was just only needed a little dial to be pushed, a little medicine to be added to my bloodstream. So a little glimpse into some of the pain of these substance abuse and addiction. So this topic of addiction is really kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of Dharma in daily life. Because there is this level of blindness that we overlook how addiction causes us pain, how it causes us trouble. This blindness, this unconsciousness, this is this quality of ignorance that we explored so much last year, is this foundation, this really this core of what keeps dependent origination arising, that keeps the cycle of suffering arising again and again. We're driven by some behavior that serves us in some way, but also harms us at the same time. And so this fundamental confusion, this fundamental unclarity, this is the expression of ignorance from the Buddhist standpoint. This is the granddaddy of all suffering. When we don't understand and don't perceive things how they actually are, that's when suffering arises. There's a classic expression of the three characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, of suffering, and also of non-self. Then we are confused about these three aspects. That's when ignorance is there. That's what blinds us to those three characteristics. When we see something that is inherently unsubstantial, inherently incapable of lasting pain or lasting happiness, and we take it as being lasting, taking it as something that gives complete happiness, that's that blindness. When we take something that is inherently impermanent, that's inherently subject to change, when we take that as being solid and unchanging, this is an expression of ignorance. And this is also the Dharma gate, one of the Dharma gates we can use to go into this topic of addiction, the addictive mind, And it's a better way to say it, because we're looking at the quality of the mind that comes up around addictive processes. Again, the most severe damaging ones to the more subtle benign ones. And we see something that is inherently harmful as pleasurable, something that is harmful as safe, this confusion. So these are deep patterns, you know, these are deep ways that drive us. And they have a large component of them is also unconscious, is operating underneath the surface. Let me take another common one, is like an addiction to sweets. You know, that sense of, let's say you go to the grocery store and get some Girl Scout cookies, which are in season now. And you have one, and then how quickly do you want another one and another one? And it's like one leads to the next one. And you find yourself really in the grip of this whole process. And yet we know if we eat too many, we'll get sick or it'll affect our health. And yet the taste is what drives it, that hunger. So addiction is really this expression of ignorance, of what's unseen, what is unknown. Because when we start to work with addiction, with the addictive mind, this quality of mind, we're really starting to work with our unconscious and work with our ignorance. We're starting to work with this basic confusion. And of course, there's a very real chemical aspect to substance abuse. And there's this whole system of dysfunction around addiction that often needs particular help, specific skillful help around. And there's also this addictive mind. The very mind itself is what we're focusing on. Now, if you work with this in a deep way and in a skillful way, it has the capacity to really transform us, to transform us in a very deep and profound way. Because it's really looking at, by working with the addictive mind, we're also working with ignorance. We're meeting it head on and starting to see through it. And it's a rocky road at times. It can be very rough because we're seeing things which we have denied about ourselves. So certainly there's the whole emotional and personal aspect of that. And ultimately, from a Dharma standpoint, we're seeing down to that illusion of self and other. So the people I've, you know, had the pleasure of knowing and meeting and working with and having as friends who have gone through a recovery program and have really have worked the steps or the process in a way that's, you know, very transformational, I always reflect on how they have this level of integrity, this level of depth and wisdom and compassion. It's like they're somehow solidly there. They stand on the earth in a different way than people who haven't done that work. You know, especially once you haven't examined that tendency in themselves. Because they've discovered something very deep about themselves, you know, something that is unseen. They've faced something very deep. Those inner demons have been met and explored and voiced and seen. You can almost think of this process of recovery as kind of a modern expression of the hero's journey. You know, thinking back to mythology and how the hero has all these trials they go through and these helpers that come in and they self-sabotage and they make their way through, and there's always the very low point that happens. And at some point, what's asked of them is to really transform themselves in a very profound and deep way. And this motif, this theme is, you know, showed so much in our media, in our movies. It's always very, I find it very poignant and touching to, you know, see the story of someone going through that trajectory skillfully, to actually meet through it, and how it's often things get very bad before they finally face themselves. And so people who have gone through this work in a deep way have learned to face themselves in a way that is, you know, it's very, you know, brings a lot of admiration in me, in my heart, and inspiration of how to meet that. because they face their inner demons. You know, that's not the external monsters, the hydras and the minotaurs. It's their inner demons, which are the most difficult to meet. And of course, the process of addiction is trying to navigate those inner demons. And by meeting them, they've been transformed. And of course, it's a process. There's always deeper levels of transformation and work to happen. These journeys are, you know, mapped out, of course, famously in the Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps, and also in some Buddhist interpretations, like the 8-step recovery by Valerie Mason John or Vilma Sara. You know, she came to Sims a few years ago, maybe 6, 7 years ago now, and, you know, got to spend time with her at a conference and a teacher's conference. And, you know, she's a very solid person, a very delightful person, also very deeply worked with this topic. So both of these processes, and often we do need that structure to help us navigate the worlds of addiction. And even from the addictive mind perspective, to first acknowledge that there is an issue, there is a problem, to really take that in. And how that mirrors the first noble truth, that there is dukkha. There is suffering here. If you don't acknowledge that, if you gloss over that, there's no movement into the practice. There's no movement toward recovery. And then there's faith. And these are just kind of the common themes of both of these traditions, not mapping out each of the steps here. But there's a faith that there's some way out. There's some hope that there's a way of moving through this. You know, whether it's in a higher power or it's through understanding the teachings of the Buddha, there's some other way that acknowledges, even just trusting the people who have gone before you. And this is part of the hero's journey. This next aspect is that moral inventory, to really start to look at what you have done in your actions, and to start to take full honest stock of that. I appreciated the wording in the 12th step, to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, this is not denying anything, but to see what is actually here. You can see how this is this inner transformation, this willingness to meet what you've been denied. Meeting what's here, what's been hidden, what's been avoided, you know, lied to. This is also freeing up that ignorance, freeing up seeing through the delusion to see things how they actually are. Right? So there's part of that seeing the personal pain and the actions and impact of your actions. And ultimately, there's seeing through that, even seeing the emptiness underneath that. Taking amends, making amends to those who have been harmed. And then deepening more and more into this process. And finally, giving back, having that sense of coming back into from a place of health, a place of integrity, to start to share and support others along their journey. So this is kind of a rough outline of that recovery pathway. And so even if we haven't struggled with substance abuse, I think there is a way that it's important to hold those as teachings, as a way to deepen our own lives, how to have that sense of deep honesty with ourselves, the sense of surrender, a sense of not hiding from what may be troublesome and broken in our lives, to actually meet that and find ways of meeting it healthily without avoiding it through distraction. And of course, you know, these kind of, especially recovery, having the structure, having the support of peers and mentors, I think is what makes these processes really work. And those who have, you know, in the Sangha, who have walked this path, know this much more than I do, because I haven't walked it in that way. I've just observed the impact, the transformation that's happened in those I've met. So now let's talk about more working with the addictive mind, and just kind of more the run-of-the-mill addictive mind, although it still applies to even the more deeper levels of addiction. And so first of all, as the homework will suggest, is to pick one area that you struggle with around addiction. Okay, so it could be something like social media. It could be something like some aspect of food or eating. It could be something like exercising, some technology. It could be anything that comes to mind that you find those three kind of working definition qualities. Again, the three ones are, it tends to grip us. We have trouble letting go of it. It tends to have a life of its own. That it's tied to some kind of pleasure or benefit. It may not be so obvious what that benefit is, but it's there if you look. And then finally, it has drawbacks. It has impacts. It has ill effects within our life. So choosing one area to kind of focus in on to see what is here. Now, it's important that this is done because you want to do it, that it's a choice that you've made yourself. You know, and hopefully you can have a quality of curiosity and interest, of lightness around it, without having so much suffering and pain embedded in it. Because but the interest allows us to see it clearly. And the seeing is what transforms. The seeing is what helps us to heal from that. But sometimes we do need, you know, we need things to fall apart. We need that falling apart of our lives to have the motivation to see, to actually look closely, as they say, to hit bottom, to really hit that bottom and see that there's just no other choice but to look. Because often the benefit may outweigh the cost, at least initially. You know, it may just feel like it's worth it. I enjoy what I get from this activity. So from a dharmic standpoint, we're not saying do this or not do this, but to notice, to actually see, to actually clear up this realm of ignorance, to see exactly how things are, not how you wish they were. And once we start to release that sense of, you know, of judgment and actually see it, and again, if there's this heartfelt turning toward to see, start to look at what is clearly suffering. What is actually dukkha in this moment, in this activity? What is this quality of the mind itself? You know, what is benefiting me in this behavior? And then also reflecting, where is the suffering with it? You know, where's the pain in this process? As you explore this sense of what's this benefit is of this activity or this action, this behavior. Also start to notice, reflect, what is truly beneficial? Remember, the Buddha would often define something being beneficial as it leads to the end of suffering, that it leads to liberation. You know, what leads to lasting peace? What leads to that quality of happiness that Naomi Shihab Nye so beautifully articulated? Another helpful thing to work with when working with this addictive mind is to learn to shift from the activity to notice the mind itself. Okay, so this is what we explored last month, or this earlier this month, is that shifting from the particular habit to noticing what does the mind actually feel like when I'm in a habit. So same to you here, notice what does it feel like to be in the grip of addiction, this addictive mind. What does it actually feel like as a mind state? What's the shape of that? Is it spacious and open and free, or does it have a quality of contraction and limitation and conditionality? Just to notice, again, try to notice how it is, not judge how it is. The more you can put that judging habit on the back burner, where you can let that relax, the more you'll be able to see. So there's a faith, a sense of trust that seeing is actually what transforms. Seeing clearly is what transforms. So get to know what this mind is like, an addictive mind. And you use the behavior as a way to help identify the mind's presence, this quality of the addictive mind. And of course, the Dharma offers this profound tool of mindfulness that, you know, many people have found is so helpful when working on recovery. And we can use it just when the addictive mind comes up to pause, to slow down, and to see what is the mind's shape here? What's this kind of quality of it? I'm not articulating that very well, but it's like there's this, if you're able to observe it, it's quite surprising how contracted that mind can get. You know, and somehow we just overlook that contraction in the pursuit of that pain. So stepping back and seeing that contraction. So even though, you know, it's helpful to really step back and notice the mind state itself, the addictive mind, you still have to attend to the behavior. We have to have some way of working with it skillfully. So it doesn't matter if it's around food or sweets, around technology, social media, around exercise, around sexuality, around substances. You know, all these will trigger this addictive mind. So these behaviors, just pick one and play with it, having a sense of curiosity around it. Now, also, this is kind of a paradox to what I just said. There's also this sense of the know of love that sometimes my teacher Rodney would talk about, the know of love, the sense of, I'm going to stop right there, or I'm going to pause right there. And so it's this interesting paradox that when you find yourself engaging in some addictive behavior, you have this choice point of either just blindly going down it, blindly following through on that impulse and reinforcing it, or pausing not from judgment, but from a sense of wisdom, just saying, let me pause, let me be awake to this, let me be present for what's here. This is the know of love. Because if your mind is like my mind, it's so easy just to give over to it, just to fall into it, and just let it carry itself. And before we know it, we've spent hours and hours in that activity, or eaten the whole box of Girl Scout cookies, or whatever it might be. And just to say, let me pause. And so the structure around that is so helpful, that sense of, what kind of structure do I need to set up? What kind of container is another way to say it, to help support this? So when you're feeling balanced, when you're feeling kind of clear-headed, where you're not in the midst of one of these addictive processes, step back and see what kind of structure, what kind of triggers happen that make that arise, and what kind of container can I put on it? How can I bring some sense of boundaries around it so I can explore it? So it's almost like you're creating a sense of a container to hold this experience. So it might be something as simple as the next time I, you know, see a Girl Scout cookie box, to use that example, and I have a cookie, I'm going to pause. I'm going to have one cookie and then I'm going to wait 2 minutes and just feel my body, feel my what's going on in the mind. So this simple quality of pause. And give yourself permission to eat the whole box. You just have to do it 1 minute or 2 minutes between cookies. And just notice what you notice. This comes into also the play between willpower versus renunciation. But sometimes often with addiction, there is a certain amount of willpower that has to come in initially. But if we're not careful, it has a rigid quality, as a sense of kind of white knuckling it, of kind of bearing until I'm through this, versus the quality of renunciation, which is, again, it's a sense of letting go, but almost more like it lets go of you. You know, so what I like to do when I'm working with renunciation is to feel, have this intention, okay, this is no longer serving me. How can I release it? But then noticing where it's stuck, where it's held on, you know, where that place is. I remember back in the long, long time ago, when I was working in the Forest Service, sometimes we would be fitting a bridge over a creek, and would have to, rough cut a log over it. And you want to get that log nice and fit. But you know, it wouldn't fit right, so you would notice where it's rubbing, and then you would kind of wear, scratch away or carve away that part until finally you got a good fit. Okay, so that's the same process that we use, is noticing where we're kind of held, where those tethers are. And again, simply being aware, simply stepping back and saying, okay, what's present here? Where is it? Where is it connected into my heart? Where is it driven into me? Where is that tether? And just be curious of that, noticing where that is. What's the shape? What's the belief behind it? All held in the spaciousness of mindfulness, of wisdom, compassion. So you start to see it more and more clearly. When it's seen completely, then it releases. So this is all about seeing through delusion, seeing through ignorance. This is the, when I look at this addictive mind, it's really personifies in a very painful way how contracted the mind gets around something and how driven by ignorance it is. How our activity, our actions of mind and body and speech are really driven by that ignorance. Right? So stepping back and learning to just see what's here, what's unconscious. As always, asking the simple question, where is the dukkha? Where is the cessation of that dukkha? So the addictive mind. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments and then I'll talk about the homework. So before we move into questions, and I see that one question from the chat with Molly, we'll get to that in a second. I'm going to put the homework in the chat. And I didn't have a lot to say tonight, so if you have questions around this or ways you'd like to explore, please bring those forth. That really helps us flesh out the topic. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about this homework here. So this week, picking one area that you find addiction arising, you know, one area that it arises in your life. You know, I would recommend making it something that's fairly uncharged. It's fairly benign. You know, don't pick something that is so strong because it may be overwhelming. It's good to just learn the process of how do I see this addictive mind. If as soon as you get into it, you just get carried away by it, you lose your footing. You lose your sense of spaciousness, perspective. So exploring one area of addiction to explore dharmically. Okay, so it can be around social media, could be something around eating, could be something around some activity. So the intention is to understand and learn instead of overcome and eliminate. So let me just reemphasize that. Usually we see something like addiction and we already are trying to get rid of it. That's the reason we look at it, you know, of course. But that attitude, if it's not really seen, it sets us up in this sense of trying to overcome. We're fighting with our mind. Through that fight, we just kind of get more and more tense. And there's parts of ourselves which just kind of hide away because you're coming in hostile. So keep reflecting on this. It's to look, it's to understand and learn, not to overcome and eliminate. Let this let go of you instead of you let go of it. Then reflect on what structure or process would help you pause and be mindful of that activity of addiction. Okay, so some quality of pausing, some quality of structure, some reminder almost like the temple bell that says, okay, it's time to pay attention here, to show up. So like with eating, it can be a nice way to do something like, okay, I'm going to eat sitting down, and I'm going to make this almost a ritual for the thing that I find that addictive quality mind being triggered. Make it a ritual of sitting down, observing, feeling everything. It doesn't have to be, you know, for hours and hours, just a few minutes, just to start to bring some consciousness to this. We're trying to see through what is unseen, trying to see through the delusion. And then with this mindfulness, here's interesting, notice where the pleasure is with this activity. You know, it has some benefit. Where is that? Is it in the body? Is it in the mouth? In the eyes? Does it feel like it's something deep inside, like the chemicals in your bloodstream get altered by the dopamine hit or something like that? Just to notice that. What is the pleasure? Where does it lie? Notice also where the benefit might be is another way of saying it. How does it kind of enhance you? And then also notice where the suffering and pain reside. Where does the suffering and pain reside with this? Often, well, let you figure that out for yourself, because it's much better for you to see it for yourself. And be curious. You know, don't have any preconceptions, pre-ideas of what should be there, shouldn't be there. Bring that quality of curiosity. And I would, you know, do this for like a short period so you can stay fresh and alert for it. And then just relax and let yourself do what you're going to normally do. But see if this starts to bring, again, that seeing through, trying to see through delusion, seeing through our ignorance to see really what's present. So I hope you enjoy that exploration. And next week, actually, Steve Wilhelm is going to be covering for me because I'm going to be on vacation with my family for spring break. And he will offer a talk and hopefully have a chance to work with this homework. So now we have a chance for some comments, questions, sharing, whatever you like. And also, let me get back to Molly here first off. Okay, so the name of the person who had the 12-step approach to, let me put it in chat, actually. Vim Sara or Valramation John, and it's called 8-step recovery. And I'll throw that in the chat for you, Molly. Yeah, she's a lovely person. Again, a lot of depth of practice. Sorry, the chat gets kind of truncated there, but you can see the difference. Okay, so you have permission to unmute yourself, so you can do that, or you can raise your hand. All right, hello.
Oh, someone unmuted me, but I was the one who had that question that you answered. Thank you so much, Tim.
You're welcome, Molly. Okay, Katie.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like I've been asking so many questions lately, but
that's great.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference between habits and addiction. So the homework that you were bringing to us, the first thing I kind of thought of was my Peloton bike, like exercise. I'm very, very obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. But how do I know if that's really a habit or addiction? Like it feels kind of subtle to me.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could speak more to that and kind of how to work with like the differences between those two.
Yeah, it's a great question. What is the difference between a habit versus an addiction? And I think it's often, you know, how strongly does it tend to grip us? You know, can we let go of it pretty easily? Or is it something that I kind of feel that withdrawal of not doing? So that's one component. Like, remember my kind of three working definitions. One was that sense of it has a life of its own. Like, we set everything else aside in order to just do that one thing. Then you have to look, are there some downside to it? Does it cause any difficulty in your life? Do you make choices like, I'm not going to be with this person because I have to do my biking, for example? You know, you can make a choice that, you know, my biking is more important than you know, talking to a friend or something, you know, just as an example. And then the other one is the benefit, you know, how does it serve you? So there's the way, there's a wholesome part. So a lot of things kind of have, it's kind of mixed, you know, it has both positive and negative parts to it. It has addictive properties and also properties which are not addictive. That's a healthy habit. So just kind of notice, I think with something like exercise, just reflect on, you know, what does it, like, do you exercise every day on it?
Yeah, pretty much. And I was kind of noticing, like, today I met up with a coworker. We were, like, socially distanced outside at a coffee shop, and it was going on longer than I thought. I was, like, getting really anxious. I was like, I got to, like, do my Peloton before I go to Sims. And I was like, but I, like, love her and I missed her and I wanted to, like, hang out with her. But I also was, like, really drawn to wrapping up so I could get on my bike. So to me, that feels a little bit more like it has an addictive quality to it.
Maybe a very mild addiction, or it might, you know, might be a much bigger one if you know, had to, like, every day seek out a bikes wherever you are. I mean, you just have to explore it. So, like, with something like this, remember the homework is just simply don't change the behavior, but just be more conscious of it during it. So maybe before you get on the bike, just set a timer, spend 5 minutes just kind of feeling how your mind and body feel. Is there a sense of, like, I have to get on it? Or, like, that a great example with your friend is like, oh, I've got to get on my bike before Sims. You know, so you kind of have to just notice that. There's no right or wrong around it, but just to become aware of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it sounds like it could change as things do, like, moment to moment as well, like, day to day. Maybe something easy for me to let it go, and then others, for some reason, it's not. There's some story around that or some fear that's coming up.
I think that's it's an insightful comment, is that there is, that's why I like the phrase addictive mind, because sometimes that just gets triggered and sometimes it doesn't. So the exact same behavior, sometimes you can meet it without any kind of grasping or holding on to, and other times very much not, you know, a different way of doing it. And it does change from day to day, from moment to moment.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Does that help, Katie?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your question. All right. So I saw a chat from Gary, and then we'll get to Michelle. Okay. So let me talk about that. He's just recommending another book. And I'm just hesitating because if I open to that, then I'll suddenly get all kinds of suggestions and then it kind of take us away from the expiration. But that sounds like a good resource, Gary, and I'll take a look at that. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so Michelle.
Hi, Tim. I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship between addiction and personality type or tendencies, I guess personality tendencies. I think I'm specifically thinking about, you know, like when I went through periods of really major crisis, I became quite aware of my propensity or desire to control. And it was only through kind of losing the ability to control that came up. And since then, when kind of maybe a more minor crisis pops up, I notice I'm rushing. I have, like, my behavior isn't like hopping on a bike, you know, like Katie, but it feels really similar. You know, the behavior is I'm going to do as much as I can. I'm going to contact this person or take care of these things. It's a compulsive behavior that centers around a need for control. And when you were talking, I thought, oh yeah, I'm really addicted to control. But that's just not the kind of thing we usually talk about when we talk about addiction. So I was wondering if you can speak to that.
Yes, it's a great question. And I was I was taking a walk with my wife today and just, you know, talking about this topic. And, you know, she said, well, you're addicted to control. I was asking what I was addicted to. And so she said that. It's like, well, you know, I was trying to see how does it, you know, part of it is an arbitrary, you know, we're talking addiction versus habit or, you know, all these different patterns. But let's see if we can kind of explore that a little bit. So, you know, again, a lot of it comes down to, let me just feel my way through that for a second. Okay, so this is what I'm gonna say. I don't know if this will be helpful or not. But for myself, the way I kind of look at it is what is the most helpful entry point into this thing? Okay, what's gonna most likely start to help me liberate around it? And so for me, when I look at control, especially around control when things are falling apart, you know, and you know, things are very difficult, or just the run-of-the-mill control. You know, that you spoke of in both those areas, and I know you've gone through some very difficult times. You know, so control, for me, that's a manifestation of the sense of self trying to say, okay, I want to try to establish myself. I want to find some way of overcoming this characteristic of impermanence, the fact that things are always in flux. I'm trying to assert myself. Because when I notice this, because when I release control, I become less defined. You know, I become, you know, a little more amorphous. It's like, well, you know, something fundamental seems to fall away that I base my life upon. And instead, you know, after I get through the kind of the fear of that, there's a sense of meeting life how it is. So for me, control is kind of the gateway is more looking at the sense of self and anatta and how that all kind of forms around that. Now, as opposed to addiction, is kind of this almost denial of, when I was exploring this, anatta didn't really come up strongly for me around this exploration. It was much more around just how the sense of ignorance, the sense of blindness, that this behavior is pleasurable, but also causes pain and not seeing that. And, you know, control has that component too. So addiction might be the right gateway for you to get a handle. I guess what I'm trying to say, you have to find what is the right handle for your mind, your exploration around it. And you can be very addicted to control, and it can have all those components, and that might be the right gateway into that. Is to say, okay, you know, there's this benefit of feeling like I have some control of things. I can help guide it the way it should be guided. And there's also the drawback. There's also the pain of it. So I'm kind of, I don't know if I'm giving you a clear answer, but that's the bottom line is what, you know, what's the entry point? You know, what starts to open us into a deepening?
That is helpful. Because I do have an experience of looking at it, as you had said too, with kind of a non-self viewpoint. But during your talk tonight, it was just another facet. It was another way to see it of, yeah, it has these benefits and it has these drawbacks. It's helpful to look at it from that angle.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You. Yeah. And that's, now that you said that, I like that too, that sometimes we look at something just from one way, and looking at it from a completely different way can be very helpful and insightful. It's like, oh, let me look at this as an addictive process. And it just starts to shake up, you know, things, because we can kind of get, without knowing it, entrained in a particular relationship to that thing we're looking at, and looking at it from a completely different way, it's insightful. Yeah, so it's all good. Thank you, Michelle. All right, anyone else like to share or ask anything?
Yeah, Tim, I have a question for you.
All right, go ahead.
I've noticed in the past that a lot of my, maybe not addictions, but certainly bad habits come up when, you know, I'm quite stressed or in distressed. Mm. And one of the challenges, you know, for instance, I'll throw something out there. So if I'm super stressed out at work In the evenings after putting the kids down, I'll just get on the computer and, you know, just, you know, look at social media or anything really, just rehashing something just so I get my kind of brain off of work. But in those instances, it's super challenging because the mind isn't in a really good state to work with. You know, it's stressed out. It's fighting, you know, some battles at work. It's just, you know, kind of wanting relief. And I wonder if there's some way to kind of invite, you know, invite that kind of looking in that mode, or if, you know, or if, I don't know, part of me feels like, well, maybe sometimes it's okay to let the mind get its relief. I don't know.
I think so, Alan. Yeah, I think sometimes that kind of wise distraction or that wise oblivion is really helpful, you know, especially when you look at the conditions that, you know, you've been overtaxed, over busy at work, and, you know, the busyness of getting children to bed, is like, I just need some time to decompress. And so consciousness around it, that's, you know, I think we can get trapped just as easily in putting ourselves in the ideal of how we think we should be as a meditator or as a spiritual person, or however it might be. We say, okay, then I shouldn't be that way. You know, and so to say, okay, I'm going to give myself the permission to just unwind and just going to let the pressure come off. Because there's also wisdom in that too. And there's also a wisdom in you know, finding that place of, it may not be a conscious wisdom, but you know that, you know, I just need to do something to disengage. And so what I would recommend is, you know, when you do that, just after you kind of had a chance to kind of let the energy disperse from the day, just pause for a moment and just notice, okay, what's the mind state right now? And what's really beneficial here? You know, it's kind of like if you're sitting and your body's really hurting and finally you let yourself release, you know, get out of the posture and you're, okay, my legs feel better. Then you can actually step back and say, okay, what's here right now? You know, what's really needed? What's really beneficial? And particularly notice the should, you know, the mind that says you should do this or shouldn't do that. And instead, you know, compassion. You know, compassion is meeting the most tender part or the tender area and asking what it needs. That willingness to turn toward that area and ask what it needs. And it might need to just, you know, chill out on Instagram and just, you know, let your mind go wherever it goes. Or it might need to go for a walk, or it might need to do something different. So there's that turning toward and asking what it needs. And sometimes we need to find a, you know, place of kind of disengagement to have enough space to actually be able to do that at all. Does that help, Alan?
Yeah, it helps. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah. Don't feel like you should always be 100% mindful. It's like, yeah, it's like sometimes we just really, we have such busy lives, you know, especially with, sounds like with work and the conditions of young family, you know, we there's no time for ourselves. So it's okay to take that. All right. Thank you, Alan. Unless there's anything else?
No, thanks, Tim.
All right. So let me get to Rob and then we'll get back to Emery in a second. Let me see. Rob sent me a chat. Sorry, I should bring my glasses for these chats here.
I can say it if you'd rather.
Sure, go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the homework, and it seemed that you were mentioning sort of two main things, which, you know, the first one was like sort of trying to get insight or see, you know, what's the benefit of this activity? And then the second one was, what is the suffering that's right. associated with the activity? And I just wondered if there's a third thing, or maybe, you know, this third thing is just part of the two, but I mean, is it worth also trying to see or examine, you know, maybe what sense of lack this activity is helping to fill, or, you know, that's basically my question.
Yes. Yeah. I think the way I kind of phrased those two questions was to kind of keep it more, you know, not to pre-program it, especially we also talked about lack quite a bit last talk, I think. And just to give a chance to see, you know, what you know, kind of a fresh question, like, okay, well, what is the benefit here? And, you know, what is the drawback? And see, you know, you can often see how there is, it's trying to overcome that lack. It's trying to fill that lack is the benefit. And the drawback is that lack actually gets reinforced perhaps by it. But to see that for yourself. So it's, I think it's for my reason I wrote it that way was just, it was kind of embedded in that, or it may be something that you discover for yourself, but it's perfectly fine to bring that lack to the forefront also. All right. Does that help, okay. Rob?
Yeah. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. All right. Emery.
Hi. I wanted to thank Michelle and Ellen for their questions. They felt really relevant to me and kind of wanted to follow up and piggyback on them a little bit. Because I like thinking about my own addictions, I really feel like my addiction is related a lot to busyness and control and always being on task and always doing a million things on a to-do list and often in the service of others or trying to help. And it's, so it kind of relates to both Michelle and Alan in that way. And I find it's very compulsive and completely like I feel very lost in it. Like it's the right thing to do and it's the right way to be and I can't really stop. And it also is like sort of an MO. It's like, it's just the way I operate. So it's an addiction and I can see it as an addiction, but it's like from about, you know, 7 a.m. when I get off my meditation mat until I get into bed at like 10. So it's hard to interrupt because it feels like it's such a way of being. So I guess my question is, do you have any skillful way to get started with that? I mean, and I feel like I did a little bit over the last month with habits. But man, it's just fleeting. You know, I could like notice it for a very short time and then I'd be like, yeah. I can't sit here and notice anymore because I have so much to do.
You're wasting time.
Right. You got it.
Yeah, it's a tough one because, you know, something like that, we see the benefit. It helps, you know, the household work well. It helps, you know, your work go better. I mean, it has a clear benefit and people probably appreciate that about you too. That, well, we can count on her to take care of things. Right. And, you know, so the, you know, first question is around just, you know, is it addictive? And you can often see by contrast, if you say, okay, for the next hour, I'm not going to do any of that behavior. You know, it's like, you know, it's asking someone like, I don't have a trouble with drinking. Okay. Let's take a day or two off drinking. How easy is that? You know, and we feel that, okay, I can't survive without it. You can see addiction really in relief in that point. Okay, so there's that piece. But it seemed like you're kind of already on board with that. You just don't have the time to. things will fall apart if you don't do it. Okay, so try this. this is what I've done personally too, is talk to your family, your husband, your kids, and ask them if there's any aspect of that behavior which is painful for them. Is there any aspect which, you know, is hard, they don't particularly appreciate about you exerting your control? And really have a dialogue about that, you know, not having any defensiveness, not trying to justify it. Like, well, if I don't wake you up, you're not going to get up for school. You know, just don't let all that go, but just really listen to the impact of your behavior. And when I've done that with my own family and really taken it in, it's like, oh, wow. Like I'll give an example from my vacations. I would often get really uptight about leaving on time. And so, you know, it was really, I would just create, you know, a lot of harshness and, you know, irritation around trying to get packed up and leaving on time. And of course I was doing all the packing. And so I was overworked too, you know, kind of like what Alan was talking about. And, you know, but then we start the vacation, everybody was upset. And it's like, okay, we're going on vacation. This doesn't make any sense. And I asked them what that experience was of me when I was in that mode. And then when I really heard that, that's coming down to that really feeling the impact of it. And that's kind of sobers us up from that addiction. And you have the motivation. And also, you know, you want to you want your family to be happy, right? So there is that listening to that impact, listening to the pain that's caused by that behavior. And then see if that doesn't start to change how you relate to that behavior. And come up with some real clear ways, like maybe three different strategies. And so sometimes I would just like, when I really stopped trying to control getting ready to go, my wife would have to pick up that role. Because like, well, we got to get going. We're going to miss the ferry. And if I just get... It was actually, once I took it on, it was really a release to let that go. But feeling, you know, hearing the pain that you're causing through that behavior, I think is a nice way of doing it. I mean, it's not a nice way, but it sobers you up. It cuts through that. This is really for their own benefit because you can't hold that illusion anymore. And then that starts to become this opening to start to see other areas that you control. And you can maybe step, you know, pause before you go into something at work, for example. You know, and I know what you, from our time on retreat, you know, that profession and that work, and just pausing for a second and saying, okay, who am I really serving here? You know, am I serving my own need for control, or am I really serving this other person? You know, and so you start to bring just a little bit of a pause and see, just check that motivation and open your eyes and see if they're really receiving it well, if they're resentful. All right. So how about that? Try that.
Thank you so much. That's really, really helpful way to step back. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. You're welcome, Emery. Good to see you.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else like to share anything? Probably have time for one or two more. Good, everybody else is no problem with addictions. That's great. Now, I know we've talked quite a bit, so maybe that is enough. Just give a few more moments here. All right. So thank you for sharing this evening with all of us. And hopefully you get a sense of the Sangha, even though we're not together physically. And there's people from Portland. There's people from San Francisco. I'm sure all parts of Seattle and other places I'm not aware of. So it's wonderful to come together. So again, next week, Steve Wilhelm will be here and offering a talk, some teaching. And we have an intro class starting this Thursday, April 1st. Oh, sorry, in Los Angeles from Molly. Wow, California contingent. Intro class is this Thursday, the 1st of April. And if you know someone or would like to just, you know, explore the meditation technique, we go through it in a really systematic way. And it's a very helpful review of the fundamentals, but also a very deep review. So you're welcome to join us there. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks.